Welcome to Today on Broadway for Tuesday, June 13th, 2017. I'm Broadway World's Matt Tamanini.
And I am Broadway Stars James Marino.
James, today, the first real day for Broadway to get back after the Tony Awards, brings two great stars back to Broadway. The first, the absolutely wonderful two-time Tony winner Donna Murphy, joins the company of Hello Dolly as Bette Midler's alternate. This is been kind of an interesting story. We've known that she was going to join the production from way before the show even began previews, but they were going to wait until after the Tonys for them to add an eighth performance. And now you will be able to see Hello Dolly eight times a week, seven times with Bette Midler, once with Donna Murphy. So I am very excited to see how the reviews are for her, because she is wonderful. And I wouldn't be surprised if at some point after Bette leaves the production, assuming that they keep it running, that Donna might take over full time, because I'm sure that her Dolly Levi is fantastic. Also trying to replace somebody that has done very well at the box office, which we'll talk about. Betsy Wolf takes over as Jenna in Waitress. She obviously is replacing the show's composer, Sarah Bareilles, who not only had a nice little comic moment on the Tonys, but has done very well for the box office for Waitress. Again, we'll mention the grosses here in a little bit. So welcome back to Broadway for both Donna and Betsy. And one last thing, James, last night at the unfortunately deciding fifth game of the NBA Finals, the Hamilton tour cast, which as everybody knows is currently set up shop in San Francisco, the Skylar sisters and Aaron Burr, sir, performed the national anthem. It was fantastic. And James, as far as I'm concerned, obviously the national anthem needs to be patriotic. It needs to be respectful, but most importantly, it needs to be fast. I don't need anybody, you know, belaboring the national anthem and making it all about them. And the Hamilton cast not only performed it wonderfully, had great harmonies, a really interesting arrangement, but they did it fast. Did it fast. I liked it. It was very, very good. We'll have a video of that in the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com if anybody wants to check that out.
I might have to take issue with you then.
Why is that?
Have you not seen Lena Hall do the national anthem?
She did it at a, yeah, I think actually, James, like a year, didn't we, like one in one of our early episodes, she did it like a minor league baseball game.
Yes.
I remember that. I don't remember it taking a long time though.
She did all the verses.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yes, yes. Yes, yes. I do remember that now. Yeah.
And it's like seven minutes.
And everyone around was like, yeah, all they had cameras on the players, and they were like, what is going on? Is she making stuff up? Yeah. But that's Lena. She can get away with whatever she wants. But if you're just going to do the national anthem, let's just do it, especially at an NBA Finals game.
No, I agree. Absolutely. I just thought that was funny. All right. So first up in the news, statements and reviews come for the Shakespeare in the Park's Julius Caesar.
Yeah, James, this has kind of become the story that we anticipated it would be before the production started previews. But the public theater has been embroiled in this controversy now for a couple of days, and they finally made a statement about their Trumpian production of Julius Caesar. I'll read it to you. It's pretty short here. We stand completely behind a production of Julius Caesar. We recognize that our interpretation of the play has provoked heated discussion. Audiences, sponsors, and supporters have expressed varying viewpoints and opinions. Such discussion is exactly the goal of our civically engaged theater. This discourse is the basis of a healthy democracy. Our production of Julius Caesar in no way advocates violence towards anyone. Shakespeare's play and our production make the opposite point. Those who attempt to defend democracy by undemocratic means pay a terrible price and destroy the very thing they are fighting to save. For over 400 years, Shakespeare's play has told this story, and we are proud to be telling it again in Central Park. James, Public Theater Artistic Director Oscar Eustis also delivered a fairly similar statement before opening night on Monday. There is video of that, and many, many people, including Amber Tamblyn, posted a video. She was there, so she posted a video on social media, but multiple people did. So you can check out Oscar's full statement in the show notes if you want to, but it was pretty much in line with their official statement that they released on Monday. But that didn't stop other people from making statements. The NEA actually put out kind of a surprising statement that they confirmed that they had no financial support of the public theater's production or Shakespeare in the Park at all this year. Dramatists Legal Defense Fund actually stood up for the public theater, which is not too terrible of a surprise. But it was just kind of a whole weird day of statements, James. What was your sense of how things played out yesterday?
I live in very much an echo chamber, so I tried to get out of the echo chamber, and most of my non-theater friends were like, "What? Julius Caesar?" they didn't really know about it, you know, so it seems like it seems to be just a theater and political only story that the normal public doesn't really care about this. But the interesting part about this was that that other production that we heard about, that it was a Julius Caesar with Obama.
It was at the Guthrie Theater in Minnesota. It was in 2012, and there was a light-skinned, tall, skinny black man playing Julius Caesar, and a lot of people have assumed that that was Obama-inspired. In fact, the actor who played him, who played Julius Caesar, said, "Yeah, I don't look exactly like Obama, but it's pretty close." It's not. I don't think it's as overtly obvious that it's Obama as this seems to be with Trump, you know, a wife of, you know, Eastern European descent. I mean, it seems pretty obvious. Oscar even threw in a few words about on Fifth Avenue into the public theater's Julius Caesar. So it wasn't as obvious, but it's not the first time this is done. This is a play of actual, you know, political substance. So it's been done, you know, over centuries. So I don't think it's the first time. I think, you know, as I've said before, and I don't want to belabor that again, the issue is that I think in the current situation, setting it up like this muddies the message that you're trying to tell. And I think it's naive not to have assumed that this would have blown up into something bigger, derailing the conversation that you were hoping to have.
Oh, thank goodness they didn't do it to an Albie play.
That's funny.
All right. What were the reviews like post the offstage antics? What did the professionals say?
Well, Jesse Green of the New York Times started things off by saying, quote, "It's depiction of a petulant, blondish Caesar in a blue suit, complete with gold bathtub and pouty Slavic wife, takes on stage Trump trolling to a startling new level." He continues, "Julius Caesar is a deeply democratic offering befitting both the public, big P, and the public, little p, and the times. If in achieving that goal it flirts a little with the violent impulses it otherwise hopes to contain and risks arousing pro-Trump backlash, that's unfortunate but forgivable. Mr. Eustace seems to have taken to heart Cassius's admonition to Brutus when Brutus is still on the fence about taking action. Think of the world, he begs. It's a line that cuts two ways." So obviously, Jesse Green defending the public theater's production, as did our friend Adam Feldman of Time Out New York, who gave the production 4 out of 5 stars, saying, quote, "The play is not an endorsement of violence. It's a cautionary tale about its risks. In Eustace's version, the chief conspirators are mostly people of color, and the mob is not a single fickle mass, but a confusion of competing groups. Social justice protesters on one side, red-hatted Caesar fans on the other, with the latter backed by merciless police. Although the cast delivers Shakespeare's verse with remarkable lucidity, the characters are secondary. The focus of this production is on political, not personal, tragedy, and it offers a dark vision of the rise of authoritarianism. Yes, the repeated allusions to Trump elicit giggles of recognition at first, but when the smoke clears 2 hours later, nobody is laughing." So again, some of the theater intelligentsia are understanding the message behind Eustace's interpretation. However, there were a number of critics who didn't see it that way, including Marian Stasio of Variety. She wrote, quote, "The Trump analogy doesn't hold up once Caesar is assassinated on his way to the Senate and is lauded in dueling eulogies, powerfully delivered by Corey Stoll's deeply sympathetic Brutus and Elizabeth Marvel's cunning Mark Antony. In death, his open bleeding wounds on full public view, the tyrant has become a god. But the insolent impersonation was fun while it lasted." This is kind of where, as I've said before, James, my issue with this interpretation becomes to you know, come more to the forefront of the plot, because it doesn't make sense that we're lauding Trump as much as they are in Julius Caesar. But Matt Winman of AM New York continues, "This heavy-handed, uncomfortable, and unnecessary stroke of provocation on the part of Eustace, who rarely directs shows himself, turns what might have otherwise been a decent Shakespeare in the Park production into a jumbled mess. The uneasy mixture of parody and earnest tragedy creates an easy target for condemnation at a time when arts funding is already under siege." I gotta admit, James, until I read Matt Winman's review, I hadn't really thought about the impact that this could have on arts funding and what kind of ammunition this could give to people who are wanting to kill things like the NEA. But that is an extra layer that I don't think people are really thinking about at this point.
Yeah, it's such a complicated issue when it comes to arts funding, mm-hmm. because people get very emotionally involved and they bring in their personal views. I think it's very tough for legislators to separate out what is best for the state versus what is best for themselves and what they consider their constituency. And that always becomes a very complicated mess. But mm-hmm. I think that the statement by the public theater in having a further discussion about these views, and especially their views that made it most clear for me, was Adam Feldman's, that talked about how it's that if these people who are protesting this Julius Caesar would actually watch the production, maybe they would have a different take on it, because it's a very complex issue. And my thing about the political side of the last 6 months is that people look for very simple answers, and we live in a very complex world, and there are no simple answers. And you have to do hard work, and it's hard. And who knew it would be so hard?
Certainly anyway. Not our president. Can we get that on a bumper sticker, though?
I'm nice, sure James. We could put anything on a bumper sticker. What should it be?
It's hard. I don't know. So whatever you just said, yeah. And well, the thing about we live in a complicated time and people want simple answers, and I like that. Whatever it is,
well, it's just too long for rewind. A bumper sticker, but
yeah, that's what I said. Rewind. You had a short version in there, so I like it. Let's do it.
Oh, short version here. Tony ratings down from 2016 record high. Shall we blame James, this on? Shall we blame this on Bette and Scott Rudin?
Yes, everything on Bette and Scott Rudin. No, I think I don't think this is a surprise to anyone following the overwhelming interest in Hamilton last year. But Sunday night's Kevin Spacey hosted Tony Awards was down 31% from 2016. However, the broadcast rating did best the deciding game of the Stanley Cup playoffs, where the Pittsburgh Penguins beat the Nashville Predators. That aired on NBC. Although when final numbers are released, it is expected that the Stanley Cup will have outdone the Tonys in the key 18-49 demo, but who cares? Theater are trying to sell tickets to older white people anyway, so they're not really competing with the 18-49 demo. Yeah, and white women too. Yeah, absolutely. The Tonys overnight rating was a 4.7 in metered market households. That is down from last year's 6.8, which was a high of the last 15 years, which is really extraordinary, and we talked about it at the time, because network television ratings, just by the virtue of the fact that there are more cable channels and more streaming options, continue to go down year to year. So last year with Hamilton's 6.8 being a 15-year high, that was astounding at the time. James, despite the fact that he joked about it in the opening number, I don't think you can blame the ratings decline on Spacey. There's nothing that he could have done. There's nothing really that anybody could have done coming off of Hamilton, the juggernaut that it was. These ratings were never going to be anywhere near those.
I think that they might not have reached the Hamilton heights, but if they had Bette Midler on and they had promoted Bette Midler being on, they would have had better ratings.
Well, they definitely promoted her being on, but you're right. They didn't promo her performing.
She should have. She should have performed. And I feel that there's got to be a better story other than a pissing match between Scott Rudin and the Tony Awards.
James, this is just a conspiracy theory that I've been thinking about. I'm starting to think that that's a cover story. I have to feel that maybe Bette didn't want to perform, because look, Scott Rudin is a lot of things, and he can be a little bit vindictive at times. But he genuinely, like the speech that he gave at the Tonys after winning Best Revival, he genuinely loves this show, this property, yeah. not just oh, yeah. this production. And so I have to think that given the opportunity, he would have done something else. So maybe having Penny in My Pocket be the number was a little bit done in spite. But I have to think that there's something else going on beyond just them not letting them perform from the Schubert Theater. It just seems too petty to be true. And maybe I'm underestimating the pettiness of theater people, but I generally tend to think that theater people have the best interest of the community at heart. And Rudin clearly loves Hello, Dolly. So I don't know.
I saw in, one of my friends on Facebook, it was maybe Leonard Jacobs, I'm not sure if it was Leonard or not, though, that said, you know, if Natasha Pierre can recreate the Natasha Pierre set on Radio mm-hmm. City, why couldn't Hello, Dolly as well? And I think that would have helped. That would have helped the rate. I think that would have really helped the ratings. That's the, you know, next to Dear Evan Hansen. In fact, probably more than Dear Evan Hansen, a harder ticket to get is Bette and Dolly right now. And that's the thing. And there are lots and lots of people who are never going to be able to afford to get to New York and buy a ticket and see this show. This is their night to see these things. And just didn't happen. And I think that, you know, no, certainly Hamilton was a huge juggernaut last year, and you're not going to best those ratings. And it's not Kevin Spacey's fault at all. So we'll see, you know, count on Mr. Riedel to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, Mr. Riedel, who got name-checked in the opening number twice.
Yeah.
Like, I have to imagine that he was on cloud nine because of that.
He probably wasn't even watching.
No, go on. He was probably there.
I didn't see that he was there. I didn't see him. All right, last week's Broadway grosses.
Well, yeah, James, Broadway's numbers were up almost universally across the board last week, coming in at a collective $34.13 million of Broadway's 35 shows. It's actually 34 because only because one, Marvin's Room, was in its first week. Only five saw week-to-week declines, and only Present Laughter and Hamilton declined more than $5,000. Present Laughter was down roughly $30,000, and Hamilton was down almost $313,000, but that is due nearly entirely to their Edu-Ham performance last week. They were, of course, still the biggest grosser, coming in at $2,741,983, followed by The Lion King and Hello, Dolly, above $2 million. Again, in just seven performances, that's astounding, with Wicked just about $70,000 away from $2 million. Next in the seven-figure club list is Aladdin, Waitress, Great Comet, Dear Evan Hansen, Book of Mormon, Kinky Boots, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Come From Away, Anastasia, Phantom of the Opera, and School of Rock. The aforementioned Marvin's Room, which played its first four performances at the American Airlines Theater, pulled in $113,000. I would imagine, like most roundabout shows, especially plays, this one will struggle for a while until the subscribers kick in and it picks up a bit. Waitress, as we mentioned at the top of the show, which bid a fond farewell to its composer slash leading lady Sarah Bareilles on Sunday, broke the Brooks Atkinson Theater record last week. James, I have to imagine that at some point, maybe after Betsy or maybe after whoever replaces Betsy, that Sarah Bareilles will come back to the show, maybe to close it whenever it closes. But I have a feeling with those box offices, she's not done with this show on stage anytime soon. Hello, Dolly and Panic at the Kinky Boots were the only two shows to see six-figure increases from the previous week. And James, this is a nice story because we poo-pooed it so early on. A Doll's House Part 2 is continuing to gain traction as it hit another high for its Broadway run, this time picking up over $80,000 to come in at $533,000. I have to imagine that Laurie Metcalf winning the Tony and giving a fantastic acceptance speech can only help that. And it looks like, again, we, you know, were very disappointed with the way that this was marketed at first. I guess Scott Rudin knows what he's doing, and maybe the same thing will happen with 1984. It won't have the Tony nominations to buoy it, but I would imagine that that one's struggling a little bit. It's picked up. It's a little higher onto the grosses chart now, but I would imagine that if it follows the same formula, it'll start doing well. But James, I think overall these are pretty encouraging numbers as we get closer to the official tourist season.
So something very interesting we didn't talk about in the Tony section is that yesterday box office wraps for Dolly were very strong. And certainly that was not based upon Beth's performance on the Dollies because she didn't perform, and it certainly wasn't based upon
the week before.
It certainly wasn't based upon David Hyde Pierce's song and things like that. So I think it's just the visibility that the Tony Awards bring to productions, and so productions might think about this and say, maybe we don't need to spend an extra $200,000-$300,000 to get on the Tonys. And I'm interested to see if Bandstand did any additional business, and we'll find out about that next week.
I think it'll probably take a couple of weeks to find out, but I just conventional wisdom would say that they helped themselves. It wasn't the best number of the night, but it sure was fun.
Mm. So in the show and casting news, Oslo extends following the Best Play win.
Yeah, yesterday the Lincoln Center Theater announced that it will extend the run of J.T. Rogers' Tony Award-winning Best Play, Oslo. It was originally intended to close this Sunday, but will now run through Sunday, July 16th at the Vivian Beaumont Theater. And sticking with Bartlett Shear-directed shows, James, the great Baz Bomaboy from the Daily Mail in the United Kingdom, who is never wrong, reported last week that Kelly O'Hara and Ken Watanabe will bring their production of The King and I from Lincoln Center to the London Palladium next June for a 15-week run. He's never wrong, so I'm sure that this is going to happen. But what's interesting about this, James, is there have been a lot of rumors about Kelly O'Hara doing Kiss Me, Kate, or really wanting to be Eliza in My Fair Lady. I'm guessing if she's going over to London to do King and I, that kind of negates her potential for being cast in either of those shows, or Kiss Me, Kate being brought in by Roundabout. So we'll have to see what happens with that. But like I said, we've reported a lot of what Baz has reported before, and he's pretty much gotten it right 100% of the time.
Sure. Absolutely. And so I have to run and get some tickets to London. don't think the restraining order holds in London. Anyway.
No, I'm probably trying. Yeah.
Why don't you get us out of here?
It's probably safe on that note. Yes, thanks for listening to Today on Broadway. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Broadway Radio. You can find me on Twitter at BWWMatt and subscribe to Something I Pop on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. James, I feel like are we taking a break?
Well, I'm going to London to get some tickets. My name is James Reiner from BroadwayRadio.com or BroadwayStars.com. As Matt mentioned, we are Audi 5000 for the rest of this week. We're going to take a little break from our daily grind of stuff. Unless something crazy happens, then Matt and I will get together from London and report that to you. So don't be surprised when we don't show up tomorrow in your feed, but we'll be back on Sunday for This Week on Broadway with Peter Felicia and Michael Portantia wrapping up our views of the Tonys. And Matt and I will be back on the following Monday. So have a great one.